history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, if you take the initiative, you're going to find some pretty incredible stories there just waiting to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we end up gaining so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. As I wait for the end of our sheltering in place to allow me to visit veterans in person again, we've been marking 75th anniversaries here on Hometown Heroes. This weekend marks an anniversary of a different number, and I'm sure you'll see a few mentions of it on the news this weekend, but 78 years ago, on April 18th, 1942, the daring Doolittle raid on Tokyo saw 16 B-25s take off of the deck of the USS Hornet for their one-way mission that would shock Imperial Japan and stir the spirits of Americans back home. This is only the second year that this anniversary has arrived with none of those Doolittle raiders still alive. What a legacy they have, one we've heard about from several who were there to watch or participate over the years. But today's program is going to focus on a different legacy, and what an incredible legacy it is. On Friday, April 10th, Good Friday, Dr. Fitzalbert Marius passed away at the age of 98. In addition to performing more than 11,000 heart surgeries, Dr. Marius was a gifted artist, poet, musician, tailor, author, and teacher who never, I mean never, ever slowed down. In fact, the last thing he did before passing in his sleep was prepare for a Bible study he was to lead via video chat the next day. We're going to hear his remarkable life story today, starting with an answer he always had ready because so many were so amazed by how many different disciplines he was able to excel in and how tireless he was in finding ways to contribute to the betterment of others.
Well, the point is, I just simply have priorities and I don't waste any time at all.
I guess not.
I take care of things, and people always ask me, God dog, Bert, how did you have time to do all this stuff? I say, I just don't waste the time. I use it effectively and efficiently. I wasn't quite 3 years old when we immigrated from Panama to Harlem, New York. The first memory I have is living in that first apartment building near 137th Street at 8th Avenue. We lived up on the sixth floor, and it was a very, very interesting situation because they were called railroad apartments in those times, and the railroad apartments don't have any hallways. Each room goes from one room to another, so you had to learn to respect each other. And on top of that, there were two apartments on each floor, but only one bathroom in the hallway for both apartments. So you had to learn to live with other people with respect. And it had an influence on the attitude that I developed. My mother and my father were both born in St. Lucia, which was a former French-speaking island, but it was owned now by the British. You know, it was one, part of the British West Indies. And it was a French-speaking island. So I grew up speaking French and English. My main ambition had always been this, to be another Rembrandt or Leonardo da Vinci. I never wanted to go into medicine or nothing else. I wanted to be a Rembrandt because my means of communicating my attitude and thoughts and feelings was in art, writing, poetry. So I didn't know how to speak to people, to communicate, I'd get down and write a poem, or I'd paint a picture. And that way I'd learn, and that's way the Lord had blessed me with that talent and line. And then what happened was when I went to Frederick Douglass Junior High School, County Cullen, one of the Harlem Renaissance poets, was my teacher. He was my teacher in French and English. And County Cullen you know, encouraged me to continue in art, you know, because naturally he was in art himself. That's all down the line. After I graduated there, and I went to Stuyvesant High School, and I was one of the few blacks there. When I graduated from Stuyvesant, I was 17 years old, and I'd received a scholarship to Pratt Institute, which is an art institute in Brooklyn, New York. And I went there for about a month. I didn't like what they were doing and stuff, so I left and I did some studying at the Art Students League in New York. Then after that, I spent 9 months in Greenwich Village with a buddy of mine, you know, and that was during the Depression. Of course, it's $10 a month, and most months we couldn't raise the $10. But we ate because there was a Village Vanguard down there, which is still in existence today. And they used to have jam sessions there. So Count Basie and Jimmy Lunsford and all those, Ella Fitzgerald and all those people used to come down after they'd finished from about 2 to 4, and they'd have jam sessions. And I met all those musicians down there. And me and my buddy would sit down, and as they played the jam sessions, we would write the poetry and we'd get up and recite it to the music, because they're playing blues or something, you know. There was a girl who came to me last night, you know, boom ba doo ba doo ba doo ba doo ba doo. And then we would recite the thing. Yes, we walked down the street with this girl you need, and so on down the line, so on. And we recite the poems, and we don't know how many of those poems they used and stuff down there. But that's how he fed us. Uh-huh. And that's how we ate. But that's all I wanted to do. The young people, blacks, today have no concept of all of what discrimination was. They think they're being discriminated, but they're not utilizing what they have. As I pointed out to them, I said, now, the whole issue is my family had 5 boys and 1 girl. All right? And 1 girl, she got in there because she was a twin, or else she wouldn't have made it. But the top was, all 5 boys in my family, and I tell this to the students in school when they ask, you know, how can you make it if you don't have income to pay for college? My people had no money, you know, they're just living from week to week and so on the line. My mother got paid 25 cents an hour for working as cleaning up people's houses. She just worked a few hours here and a few hours there. And my father was making the $7 a week. But we managed to make it. So they had no money to pay for our tuition and go on the line. But we helped each other. My older brother, to tell people, even without any help and so on down the line, and helping yourself and the inspiration and the drive of your family and so on down the line, you can still make it. My older brother wound up with 3 degrees. He wound up with a BA from City College, a master's from New York University, and a PhD in political science from Université de Paris in France. Now, when he finished, he helped me. I wound up in medicine and so on down the line, and art and various other kinds of things. We both went and helped the brother under me, and he wound up with a master's in civil engineering. The brother under him wound up with a master's in biochemistry. My youngest brother wound up with not only a master's in electrical engineering, which he worked for one of the biggest companies and the best, strongest companies there for about 2 years, decided that's not what he wanted to do, went back to medical school, and became an internal medical doctor. And we all did that, helping each other. Not with scholarships or anything else.
And I guess the question is, because you know how unique that is, mm-hmm. and how extremely impressive that is, but rare, and if it were that easy, everybody would do it, right? So what was the secret? Why do you think that happened in your family as opposed to other families?
Well, it's not just my family, but remember, it was the attitude and heart of the people helping each other. We weren't thinking only of me, myself, and I. We were thinking of us. And we knew how to help each other and knew that you had to be productive. You could not have an attitude of entitlement simply because your butt woke up in the morning. You were entitled to the opportunity to seek employment, But you weren't entitled to the product of the employment without working. And you knew that from the beginning. So that's how we got into that. And that's what helped me all the way through college and everything else that I did. Those were days, you know, that was different than today, you know, because blacks had to do things that it was very easy for you to be the first black dad. Because black didn't have very many opportunities.
Well, that's one way to look at it, as an opportunity, when most looked at it as a brick wall that was impenetrable. Mm-hmm. But what you guys did in World War II played such a role in those color barriers falling in sports and in culture afterwards. You mentioned the fireside chats with FDR.
Yeah.
So what about Pearl Harbor? Is that how you heard about that too? Was it from FDR?
Well, now, there's how I wound up in the Army on December 7th, 1941. I can still see that in my mind. I was at Lincoln University. I started Lincoln University in 1940. And I was sitting there, and I was not going to Lincoln University majoring in pre-med. When I went to Lincoln University, I majored in architecture because it was associated with art. And so, you know, a lot of people, because here when I got in Fresno and went into general surgery and wound up with Frank DeBakey in San Francisco. That's when Stanford Lane was up in San Francisco before it moved to Ann Arbor in the days of the dinosaur. So I was in on the early things concerning the modern day heart surgery, you know, as we're known, and heart transplants and all those sort of things. But, you know, the whole point is how I got into medicine. Well, back there, after, you know, he gave that talk and said that we are now at war with Japan, we're involved in the war. It wasn't a shock to me because the whole issue was, at that time, we were isolating ourselves. We should have been involved against Hitler and stuff, along with France and Great Britain and stuff, but we isolated ourselves. That's their problem. And so the only way we got involved in World War II was when Japan chose to attack Hawaii. So anyway, what happened? At the time, one of the guys came over to me and said, now, they got an ASTP program associated with this, and that program is a different kind of program because there's a lack of certain kind of specialties in the Army. And they've put together a special program for people who are in pre-med. Instead of you going 4 years through pre-med, what they now in that new ASTP program have is that after 2 years of pre-med, they take you out of the pre-med and they put you through a concentrated 2 years of medical school. And in 4 years, you are MD instead of 8. Now, I got to thinking, now I'm working all summer, and then doing while I'm at school, in order to eat, I'm washing dishes in the kitchen. And I said, now, I don't have to do this another 2 years if I join this program. And plus that, they'll pay for my medical school. So I moved and became pre-med, and that's how I got into medicine.
So many of his patients over the years were thankful he did. So the war turned his path toward medicine, but that path was not as direct as he expected, especially after a detour born out of mistaken racial identity. I've never heard a story quite like that of Dr. Fitzalbert Marius, and you'll hear some of the most eye-opening parts of it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.